Punk rock tried to destroy the metal, but they failed as they were smite to the ground.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
Hello, my brothers and sisters of horror. Here we are, together again, under the glow of the moonlight and dripping in the blood of a dead possum I found on the side of the road. My name is Alex, and this week I talk first.
You do!
I'm joined, as always, by my two heathen co-hosts, Sam and Palmer. And this week, we're going to talk about three of my favorite things. Satan, sacrificing man boys, and heavy metal.
I feel like that's a slight. I feel like Alex wants to sacrifice
that neither one of us are in her top three favorite things.
If I was sacrificing you, then you would be.
That's true.
Alex is going to sacrifice us, so that makes us her favorite things.
It does. So I have a question. I've been listening to some true crime podcasts, and do you guys ever find yourself like listening to them describe these serial killers and be like, wait a minute, I do that. Wait a minute. I've done that.
Could you give us an example of what
no,
exactly
I
you...
cannot.
I'm having a hard time really, you know, honing in on the question without like
What kind of things do you do that you have in common with serial killers?
I would rather not discuss.
Just give us one taste.
If you've ever had that, like, where like it's the early stages, right? Nothing like advanced. I'm not out there like killing animals or anything like that, but I'm just like, I'm just like, have you ever just heard them describe like a friendship that went on or like a relationship that they had earlier in their lives and you're like, wait a minute, I've felt that way.
I've done that's
that.
Probably true.
And then you pause and you have to like not listen to the podcast for a while because you're trying to figure out whether or not you might be a serial killer.
It really sounds like you're working through some things here, Palmer.
I am. Maybe it's the quarantine speaking. I'm not really sure.
No, see, I never think of you in those terms. I think of you in the terms of like tinfoil hat wearing person that's going to end up living in a like 250 square foot shanty shed cabin thing in the middle of nowhere off the grid, as is your dream, firing guns and becoming just like the epitome of that like one character that's always in like video games or movies as like the crazy recluse.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I feel like if anyone's mother is going to turn them into a serial killer, it would obviously be Sam's.
Yes,
that's also
you're
true.
Right.
Why weren't you
I didn't
a girl?
Think about it.
Where are these shoes?
I never wanted you in the first place.
Yeah. Call me mother.
So then we've answered the question for Sam. He's definitely had that moment where he's been listening to these podcasts and been like, wait a minute.
Is that me?
Yeah.
Alex, have you?
I've had those moments.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, come on. There hasn't been a single thing where you've been
as
like,
the most
actually,
normal
you know what?
One
I'd
on the
do
podcast,
that.
I would say no.
I also maintain, like, I've had those moments too because, like, I don't really know how to, like, handle death.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Are we about to get really deep? are we about ready to have like a philosophical conversation about death?
Well, no. So it's just like I don't really know how to handle it. And like even as a kid, I don't remember it like being able to like process it in a way that made sense. So I just kind of like I'm there, but I'm just kind of like detached.
Yeah, you're.
So I just assume I'm a
your whole death. Family kind and, of is like that though. Like your dad gave me like a high five. During your grandmother's funeral, dude. I was just like, I don't know what to make of this.
Well, now I know where I got it from.
It was like the second or third time I think I ever hung out with your father. He just gave me a high five during a funeral. I was just like,
cool.
All right.
Funerals, am I right?
Well, so I guess, Palmer, what you're saying is you listen to these podcasts. You're not wondering about yourself. You're wondering about me.
No. So, okay. So, like, one of the true crime so I've had to branch out, right? Like I've had to explore mm-hmm. other true crime podcasts and one of them was talking about, I can't remember who it was. They were kind of glancing over some specific serial killer, one of the lesser known ones. And they were talking about his relationship with like a particular friend of his And so, like, one of the things that, like, they were talking about was, like, that he had, like, a fear of intimacy with his friends. And that, like, he didn't hug his friends very often or, like, you know, really do anything except, like, say hey and, like, stand in a corner and, like, was really socially awkward. And I was like, I am all those things.
Yeah, but we know plenty of socially awkward people that we wouldn't consider to turn into serial killers. That's just a trait.
When I'm out there in the garden and all I have is the chirping of birds and somebody babbling into my phone microphone, just coming out of it, pouring out way too loud and cursing every other word. But it makes me really think about myself.
Mm. See, I think you've internalized way too much Asmodel.
Maybe.
Or whatever the fuck his name is.
Who?
The Warcraft streamer who also does the gardening videos.
Jesus. There's two of you.
Hey.
Because I think you saw those videos while you were like, you had a good garden at that point. But you wanted it to become a great garden, and then you saw those videos, and you internalized it, and you're like, this is who I'm going to be. And then the quarantine happened, and it just kicked it into overdrive, because what else do you have anymore?
Maybe.
You have nothing but your socially awkwardness.
You're right. But that's the thing. So, like, it's been, like, one of those, what if that's me? What if, like, the quarantine continues for the next, like, so, like, there's all these reports coming out that are like, oh, like, concerts won't begin until... for like another year, and like big public events aren't gonna happen. They're still like a couple years off, and like blah 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 blah. And I'm just like, is that what if that's actually the case?
Right.
Like, yeah. Will I become that if this quarantine continues? If I'm left to my own devices.
If being socially awkward and lonely is the trait of a serial killer, then I think like pretty much all millennials are.
There's an entire generation of future serial killers.
Yeah, top that with like the crippling anxiety.
yeah. Speaking of crippling anxiety, we can add aliens to our list of fears.
Fear not what you don't understand, my friend.
So it's been kind of around the block already at this point, but hey, we're just going to be another podcast that talks about it too. Bloody Disgusting put up an article talking about the department. I'm just going to call it the Department of Defense from now on. The Department of Defense has officially released alien videos, which they've titled
UFO videos.
They're calling them unidentified aerial phenomena. They're not calling them UFOs.
Okay, so UAPs.
UAPs.
That doesn't have the same ring to it.
Isn't that the same thing as a UFO?
No.
I think that they want you to know that there is a difference.
I guess it's because it like disappears, like they can't like track it like physically, even though like everything I guess picks up a physical embodiment of this whole thing. Whatever it is, this phenomena that is existing in the skies is no longer being denied. Now, all these videos have already previously been leaked. Like the public has already seen this stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time that the government, the Department of Defense, I guess, in particular, has acknowledged that these things are real. Like, in the past, they've always tried to dismiss them, right? So, what do we think about this? What are our thoughts here?
It's about damn time.
So I just appreciate that, like everything else that the government does, they're just like six steps too late. Because all of these videos were released within the last couple of years by various outlets, most of them coming out of the Navy itself. And my favorite meme about it is that everything's so crazy right now. The Pentagon confirmed UFOs and nobody even knew.
Oh, yeah. No, that's like totally true.
Because like I saw that, I think, on like Monday, and I immediately had to go searching for like news articles about this, which was great. But like you mentioned, because we're, you know, tied up in this quarantine for who knows how long and potential future events, I'm really curious to know, like, what other news we're going to learn that is just going to get swept under the rug because nobody's paying attention.
They're going to release like the JFK assassination files and like,
oh my God, that'd be like, so great.
Fucking, but, you know, just everything, all of it.
I personally can't wait for the government to confirm that Hitler lived in Argentina and then built a moon base on the other side of the moon and that Iron Sky was a documentary. All while, like, some global famine is happening.
Well, the Hitler, remember that Hitler in Argentina thing that I linked to you guys that got, like, declassified?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
God, how long ago was that? Like, a year ago at this point?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's step one. So now we just need the confirmation that there's a Nazi moon base.
Five more steps.
Oh, God. I didn't realize
did you
this
hear the
is
theory?
Alcoholics Anonymous.
We're only on step one.
Did you guys hear the theory about that the UFOs are actually humans?
What do they? What? What?
Oh, like
so like they're being piloted by humans? No. So there's this theory that it's human time travelers. And it piggybacks off of this theory that, and I can't remember what the name of the theory is, but that there are no alien life forms currently that would be considered intelligent because, like, the time that we exist does not line up with the time that they existed.
Just like humans to think that right? They're the only intelligent beings out there.
Well, because the idea is, like, if they were there, we would have found them.
We would have found or they them, would have,
or they would have, or they would have found
what if
us.
They have no interest in finding us because we're so dumb.
Well, that's possible. But that's kind of where this theory comes from: is that, like, humans have left Earth in the future after, like, destroying it, because that's what we do. But with their super advanced technology and everything, they've also started going back in time to visit Earth.
Okay.
As, like, a almost like a field trip.
So look at Earth. At the Earthlings before they killed themselves. Look how dumb they are.
It's just like yeah. Miss Frizzle inside the magic school bus, just floating through.
Absolutely.
The sky.
So, like, this is one of my favorite new theories about what these UFOs are. Is that it's just like time traveling humans from the future coming back to look at us because they're all like 5,000 years in front of us and have no knowledge of
Sam,
Earth.
Just tell me
as
again
a home.
I'm the one in the tinfoil hat.
I think at this point it's safe to say that both of you have your tinfoil hats. They may be different shapes.
No, I just think this is a great theory. I'm not paranoid about it. That's why you're.
It kind of sounds like you're.
That's
paranoid
why you wear the tinfoil. What's to be paranoid about? This is exciting.
Fall into your technology fear.
Yeah, dude.
No, I'm not afraid of this. I think it's hilarious.
Are just a step ahead of them. Yeah. Black Mirror is coming, Sam.
I'm into it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I guess the official statement was that they released this in order to clear up any misconceptions by the public as to whether or not the footage that has been circulating has been real or whether or not there are more videos. The aerial phenomena observed in the videos remains characterized as unidentified.
Mm. Also, can we get another Storm Area 51 Facebook group going now that we have confirmed video footage of
there
UFOs.
Was like a meme about that I saw the other day. It was like me and the boys when we realized that everybody who works at Area 51 is working from home.
Also, I did not realize that Blink 182's Tom DeLonge was so into UFOs because apparently he was one of the people who released or posted these videos.
Arash started telling me about this shit like 2 years ago. He's like, yeah, Tom DeLonge's like financing all this stuff. And then, of course, you know, like, the UFO community's all like, blah, 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 Tom DeLonge.
Do they like Tom DeLonge, or do they dislike DeLonge?
I don't know. I'd say it seems to be, like, impartial. There are a lot of people that seem to think that he's, like, in it for the money.
Oh. Well, if he's funneling his own money into it, I can appreciate that.
I don't know. Is he? Is he funneling his own money into it?
Yeah, he is. He is funneling his own money into it. He's a co-founder of this group called To the Stars Academy.
To the Stars.
But I wasn't sure if that was like financed by other people or if that was him financing it.
I think it's a combination of the two.
Okay. How much money does Blink-182 have? Jesus Christ.
Oh my God,
Didn't they get back together with him like last year or 2 years ago for like some tour or something?
Was it with Lil Wayne? Not Lil Wayne.
Yeah, it was with
Lil
Wayne.
Lil
Wayne. Yeah, he got all pissy and
because they didn't have a big enough audience. Like,
yeah, so like the rumors behind that were the reason that he got back in with the band for that tour was because he needed more money for this.
Well, thank you, Tom DeLonge. Now we have you to thank for every early 90s, late 2000s movie soundtrack.
So here's your holiday.
And now apparently for getting the declassification of UFO videos.
Well, was this a result of his digging it up, or was it just the DOD like following up, or like, because, you know, like, didn't Trump say, like, when he got elected that he's gonna be like, oh yeah, aliens, we're gonna reveal all the aliens, blah blah blah.
Yeah, but he's also come out and said in response to these videos that he doesn't believe them and he doesn't think aliens are real.
Oh well, yeah, I mean, the foremost expert.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
In ufology.
He's an ufologist. Is that what you call? Well, I guess so. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Is that how you say UFO? I would have been like UFO or like.
I think it's UFO.
I think it's supposed to be ufologist.
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 In my head, it's ufology.
I think that's what it is, though.
So it's more
I think
like
that's...
a double O than a U. Like, I guess if you put like an umlaut on top of the U, then you could have ufology.
I'm 90% positive it's ufologist.
Is it? Oh, okay. I mean, people that are really into this, please write in and let us know if it's ufologist or not.
Also,
the New York Times did a really interesting interview with Tom DeLonge about this.
To the Stars Academy? What did they ask him? Was it anything pertinent to this?
Let's see. So they ask him how he got into all this stuff in the first place. Headlines about the Navy confirming.
I was drinking what, Crystal Skull Vodka with Dan Aykroyd.
Hell yeah.
Why the Navy's response is so important to the larger conversation. And this was from a couple of years ago. So this was after the Navy had released these videos. Let's see. I guess Luis might be his partner in this shit. I don't know who that person is. They ask him a couple questions. Apparently this guy, Luis, has a background in the Department of Defense.
Luis Elizondo. The people that he was working with were like former spooks or something.
Yeah, so he's working with a bunch of like former DOD employees and whatnot.
What's a spook?
Yeah.
Spies.
Yeah. Oh. Like people that have classified intelligence.
Okay. That sounds like such a derogatory way to refer to that.
I guess it is to an extent, but you know.
I don't care.
Come after me, I guess. I don't know. It's just interesting. It's just interesting.
The truth is out there, you guys. The truth is out there.
It is. It is. Somewhere, Mulder and Scully are getting happier and happier that this is getting nice.
Join us next week as we transition into an X-Files podcast.
I'm totally into it. Yeah. But only the original.
Like, you mean like the series?
Bullshit. Oh, yeah. Season 11 bullshit.
Weren't they supposed to do like another season? Has that ever come to fruition?
Well, I know, but we talked about it like Scully a few times. Was not going to be on it anymore.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So maybe I guess they canceled
it. Yeah, on it. Yeah, I think they were talking about doing another season without her, but maybe that didn't go through.
Yeah, must not have. All right, you guys ready to talk about some actual proper horror related news so our listeners stop turning the podcast off?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, kicking off the horror headlines, we've got more Hellraiser stuff. I guess you could say there's more Pinterest. In Hellraiser. last week, we mentioned that David Bruckner was going to be directing a Hellraiser reboot. But the news doesn't stop there. No. Earlier this week, Deadline reported that Hellraiser is also getting a TV series, courtesy of HBO.
Hell yeah.
That is an unexpected piece of information.
Dude, HBO's cranking it out now.
I guess it's the HBO Max thing. They just sent me an email, by the way. If I resubscribe HBO Now or whatever, they're like, you get HBO Max with it. Like, just do it, dude. Like, why aren't you doing it right now?
That must have changed then, because originally they were going to be separate.
Well, I think it might just be for like a year. What'd you say? Sorry?
Oh, I just canceled HBO too. Fuck.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, they just sent that to me. So they're like, oh, you know, I guess if you sign up, for now, you get Max with it and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, okay, maybe. I don't know if it's just for a year or like what the deal is, but that's what they're pimping out now, apparently.
Mm. Rumor has it eventually HBO Max is going to go away.
And just get absorbed back into HBO. So what's the point of HBO Max?
What's the point then?
Well, no. So HBO Max, is it HBO Now?
HBO Now
is going to go away and transition into HBO Max. Yeah.
Okay. So David Gordon Green, who did Halloween Kills, he's directing the pilot for this, which is also unexpected. He's also going to be doing several of the other initial episodes. Michael Dougherty, who penned Trick or Treat, Krampus, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, will be doing the script for this. I really do like Michael Dougherty. I don't think I've seen anything like bad by him. So the fact that he's involved in this, I actually trust the fact that he's involved in this more than I do David Gordon Green. So he's going to be writing the script along with Mark Verheiden, who did Battlestar Galactica.
Hell yeah.
So Deadline elaborates on the series content, saying that the idea is to create an elevated continuation and expansion of the well-established Hellraiser mythology. It is by no means a remake, but rather assumes that the past mythology to be a given. The centerpiece remains Pinhead, the pincushion-headed merciless leader of the Cenobites. I don't know that I ever considered him a pincushion-headed, but yeah,
never thought about that before.
Yeah, neither did I. The formerly humans turned demons that live in an extra-dimensional realm that are activated through a puzzle box called the Lament Configuration. The Cenobites come from hell to harvest human souls and keep the balance between good and evil. The HBO series is said to be completely unconnected to the Spyglass David Bruckner film that's coming up. So I guess we're going to see kind of like the Child's Play thing happen, where remember we were getting the rumors that there was going to be a Child's Play TV show that never came to fruition, but they were going to continue that whole storyline with the TV show, but then reboot with the films. I guess that's what's going to be happening with this. Considering HBO's involved in this, I have more reason to believe that we will see the TV show come out of this.
I would think.
Because wasn't it Sci-Fi that was involved in the Child's Play?
Yes.
So it just like never even came to fruition because
it sounds right to me.
It got canceled before it even started, which is that's advanced even for Sci-Fi Network.
It is. They're really going to the next level with this. Next up, Damien Leone has released the first still from Terrifier 2. We can probably add this to the laundry list of Corona cancellations before everything is said and done, but the film, as of right now, is still currently slated to be released in October. But given the fact that principal photography was not completed when Corona hit, it's facing pretty significant delays. This hasn't stopped Damien from being hard at work, though. He's up there editing. He's up there doing stuff, according to his official Facebook page's status. Page's latest update, rather. They're using this time to prep for our final days of principal photography, which he makes sure to highlight that there's not many left, and edit the vast majority of footage that we already have. All I can say is that you guys are in for a real treat with this film. More updates to come soon, maybe even a teaser. As always, thank you to everybody who's making this, who's been offering the amazing support. Your excitement for Terrifier 2 really motivates us to work even harder. It's ballsy for him to put T2.
I hate that so much.
That's Terminator.
That is really ballsy.
That's Terminator, buddy. I don't know that you've earned that right yet.
Yeah, I don't think that you can.
Dude, are we a movie away from seeing a crossover?
Oh God, T-1000 versus fucking Art the Clown. Let's do it. Let's do it.
I cringe to think.
Additionally, Leone has shared the first official still of Lauren Lavera. That's a porn star name if I've ever read one.
You're right.
As Terrifier 2's female lead, Sienna. She'll be starring alongside David H. Thornton as Art the Clown in the sequel. After being resurrected by a sinister entity, Art returns to Miles County, where he must hunt down and destroy a teenage girl and her younger brother on Halloween. It's really hard.
Still is hella boring.
Oh, I mean, it looks like they've upped the production value.
Yes.
That's really the one takeaway, right? You can't really comment on anything related to a film based on one still, but I think that just from this one shot, it looks like the production values have increased significantly. The lighting, the bookie, the framing of the shot all look top notch. I think
the wing.
Yeah. I think it's safe to say that all of us are really anticipating the release, and fans of over the top slasher gore will probably be as well. Here's to hoping it's not delayed too much, if it is at all.
Here, here.
And Lauren Lavera is pretty new. Yeah. So who knows? She might have done porn previously. It just doesn't show up on her IMDb. Because her first credit on IMDb, at least, is from 2017. She's done mostly shorts and TV shows. She was in that movie Clinton Road about the haunted road in New Jersey that's supposedly a true story. That came out a couple years ago, which I did watch. It was fine. The movie does get bonus points for Ice-T because I love everything that he's in. And I think, I mean, honestly, the most important part is Art the Clown and how she kind of interacts and plays off of him. Right. So,
yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
Especially because he doesn't talk. You know what I mean? You really have to have that that acting dialogue to go along with him.
I'm excited. He sent out some emails to us because we're to everybody who backed the film. But since we backed it up on Indiegogo, you know, we got one of the emails kind of updating about it, and apparently the poster signing has begun.
I want a signed poster.
Oh, we're getting one.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, dude, it's going to be exciting. And now for some news that I think you'll love, Alex.
I do.
Ken Walker, he's a world-class taxidermist and unabashed Bigfoot believer.
Ain't nothing wrong with either of those things, thank you very much.
Since the creature hasn't been found yet, he's actually set out to make one. Dan Wayne's documentary, Big Fur, A Wild Love Story, is being released on digital August 11th. The release states that Ken Walker is a world champion taxidermist. I didn't realize that was a competition.
Oh, are you? Oh, yeah, that's like very important things.
I did not realize that was a thing. I you know, I figured it was like levels of artwork, right? You know, like people would be like, oh, this guy's clearly better than this guy. You know, it'd be like comparing like something by a fucking like, you know, Hitler to Michelangelo. Like everybody pisses all over Hitler's artwork, but Michelangelo is fucking god tier, right? Like that's what I expect. You know, like you kind of like distinguish what's better and what's worse, but I didn't realize that there was a whole competition between them. Could you imagine like Michelangelo and fucking, I don't know, Da Vinci and just like all these people just like in a duel to the death with their artwork? Bob Ross.
I don't think that you realize how, or people don't realize like how hard taxidermy is until you look at really shitty taxidermy.
Yeah.
So there's a very specific quote in the trailer about this, where he says taxidermy is the most difficult form of art that's ever been created.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is it's all done by right-wingers who don't believe in art.
You know, it's done by right-wingers and also by people who own oddity shops.
Yeah.
Who usually tend to be a little bit more left-leaning.
Yeah.
IMO.
So apparently his replica of Bigfoot is called Pretty Woman. And it stands 8 feet tall, and it's covered in fur. It's his recreation of Patty, the female Bigfoot seen in the shaky 1967 movie that everybody's seen.
She's beautiful, you guys.
Big Fur documents Ken's meticulous Bigfoot recreation from start to finish, where it is unveiled at the World Taxidermy Championships. While Ken would love to win Best in Show, his real hope is that putting Patty on display will prompt some hunter to open his freezer and pull out the proof that Bigfoot is real. Instead, it's Ken's love life that gets thawed out. That makes it sound kind of interesting in a really bizarre way. And I want to know what his love life has to do with Betty.
Oh my gosh, you guys. This Bigfoot, she is beautiful. She's got breasts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm so excited. Oh, I'm so excited to see the very long-awaited sequel to this, Big Fur 2, A Wilder Love Story, where it's actually Alex's movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really just an actual documentary about her life for the next 25 years that we get to look forward to.
It is two of my favorite things, taxidermy and Bigfoot.
It's true.
It's kind of like, I feel like the sequel, not the sequel, but the follow-up to Tiger King that none of us knew that we needed until we saw Tiger King.
Jesus.
It's Bigfoot
King. Have you guys watched The Whites on Amazon yet?
No.
You need
to. Okay.
It's almost as over the top as Tiger King.
Okay. I'm totally into it.
It's pretty crazy. Next up, a new Goosebumps live action show is on its way. The series based on R.L. Stine's books, it's looming its way over to the TV screen once again. The original series produced out of Canada, which I didn't know.
I did not know that either.
Aired on Fox Kids 25 fucking years ago.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Jesus.
Like, I know I'm old, but not that old.
Right? Jeez. It just makes me, like, because I sat down and I did the research the other day after reading this was 25 years old and looked up when Power Rangers first aired. I just had to sit down and really evaluate how I view myself and my adulthood, in quotes. But Scholastic Entertainment, the media division of Scholastic, is pairing up with Neil H. Moritz, producer of the Goosebumps and Goosebumps 2 Haunted Halloween films, and Sony Pictures TV, where Moritz's original film is under a deal to develop the series. There are no details as to the plans of the new series, although Moritz promises a high-end television series that speaks to both adults and kids alike. I don't know. The fact that Moritz is involved kind of worries me. Nothing really seemed too appealing about the Jack Black starring films. Like, I remember loving the kid, like, the show as a kid.
Yeah.
And I've gone back and I've rewatched them as an adult, and they're not for me anymore, but I loved them as a kid. They actually hold up probably about as well as Are You Afraid of the Dark? Like, Are You Afraid of the Dark? I don't know. If you try to watch that as an adult, there are, like, a handful of episodes that are still really fucking good.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is just cannon fodder.
Just kind of garbage, yeah.
But I watched those as a kid religiously. I kind of want to go back and rewatch some more of the Goosebumps. I think those are all on Amazon as well. I got to check.
I always remember Goosebumps being like a little bit less scary than Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah.
If I don't remember.
There were a couple like of the books. That really genuinely scared the shit out of me as a kid.
And see, I don't remember watching this show. I know I read like
all the books.
Every single one of the books I could get my hands on, but I don't remember watching this show.
I feel like it was on at 7 o'clock.
It was on
I feel like, but I'm the same way, Sam. I definitely remember reading Goosebumps and more being into watching Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah.
I don't know. I watched them both religiously.
I'm talking about target demographics, so like, and going back and watching all this the stuff that, you know, we grew up with. Like, I've done that with a handful of like the old cartoons and stuff that I used to watch. And holy shit, they just don't.
Oh my god, dude, have you guys tried to watch Reboot?
Yes, that's exactly the one I'm thinking of. I tried to go back and rewatch it, and holy shit, it's atrocious.
Oh, no.
And it ruined in my head, because in my head, I still remember that show being
so good.
Dope.
Yeah. So good.
Is it
so
not
good.
Dope anymore?
It's not.
Oh my god, it's awful.
It's not dope.
Not dope at all. But like the first Goosebumps movie made $150 million on a less than $60 million budget and still holds solid ratings. And the second one had a smaller budget and still got brought in three times what it cost to make. The way that I kind of view it is like, if we like, or I guess in this case, if the two of you had kids like 6 years ago, when you're in your like mid to late 20s, right, and your kids are now like 6, 7, 8 years old or whatever, like that's kind of who these movies are made for, is like our generation with kids that would like to watch it, and with us in the position of like, oh yeah, we grew up with this, let's just kind of take our kids and see what they do.
How relevant are the Goosebumps books anymore?
I don't know.
I don't know if they're still relevant, or they wouldn't be making money like on the big screen. But
like, you mean are people still reading
Goosebumps books? Yeah, like are kids still reading Goosebumps books? I haven't seen anybody read Goosebumps books, like kids wise.
I'm sure there are. Yeah. You know what? It probably is too. There might be a lot of adults our age who held on to their Goosebumps books and then maybe now have given them to their kids.
I know I still have. I have a collection of stories that R.L. Stine signed that I'm planning to like give to Atticus if he. I don't know if he gets into horror, then that's awesome. If he gets into horror,
I would like force that upon myself. Yeah,
right. No, you watch this. You'll be terrified.
Yeah, fuck that. Yeah. He has no choice. We're going to see Goosebumps, and you're going to read all my V.C. Andrews books.
Fuck you, Fear Street!
Oh, Fear Street,
dude. That shit was good, dude.
That was good. I forgot about Fear Street.
The natural progression from, like, after Goosebumps books to the Fear Street books.
Yeah. Until you get to, like, R.L. Stine wrote, like, an adult novel, and it was really just creepy. Like in a bad way. Oh, like, in a, like... no. No. No, you don't need to write this.
Does it make sense if you think of it in terms of, like, this man has been writing spooky children's books for so long that when you try to write, like, a more serious adult-oriented book, this is what you end up with?
I remember, like, finishing the first chapter of it. Because, like, it came out when I was, like, a young teenager, I think. When it got released, I can't even remember the name of it. I remember the cover had like a cat on it. Stein adult horror novel. Hold on, I'm Googling while this all up. But I read like the first chapter and being superstitious. That's it.
Oh, superstitious.
Yeah, it came out in 1995. I remember getting this. So I guess I was still pretty young. Because I remember getting it when it came out. I had like the hardcover, and I got through like the first two chapters, and I remember like putting it down and just being like, this is
too weird,
this is not good.
You're like, I don't like this. That's fair. You gave it a shot.
Apparently R.L. Stein's agent gave him a $1 million advance for that book.
What?
Jesus.
Holy crap, it took him 4 months to write. I was not the only one who thought it was bad. Apparently everybody thought it was bad. The Washington Post stated that it had a tired plot and wasn't good. Thanks, Washington Post.
Tired and bad.
Yeah. Thanks, Washington Post. You're awesome. All right. Moving on to new things, sort of. Last of Us 2 officially has a release date. So this was mentioned on our list of Corona cancellations a few weeks back because it was delayed indefinitely last time we talked about it. It's fair to say that that indefinite delay seems to have really brought it to the forefront of the video game zeitgeist, because everywhere I go, people are talking about this fucking game. It's setting itself up to be one of the most anticipated game releases of all time, I think. It's been mired in controversy as of late because of recent leaks. I'm not going to comment on those, and I have no desire to talk about them because I'm staying well away from them. I have read from a bunch of sources saying that the leaks have ruined the game for them. I'm just going to play it when it comes out regardless.
How does it ruin the game for them?
I don't know. I don't want to read about the leaks. I don't want to know what they are. So, I haven't.
That's fair.
But
it's probably, I haven't looked at them either, 'cause I didn't even play the first one since it's an exclusive. It's probably, usually when you hear stuff like that, it's like there's a big twist or two somewhere along the way that these leaks probably ruined that people have probably been waiting for.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe. Like I said, I'm staying the hell away from it. But that being said, Sam, when the next console generation comes out and PS4 drops down to like a super cheap price, like honestly, you should play it.
Yeah.
It's legitimately one of the best horror games of all time. But Corona knows no allies, and as a result, Last of Us 2 was delayed indefinitely until now. Naughty Dog has confirmed earlier this week the game has been pushed to a definite June 19, 2020 release date. PlayStation's Herman Holst said in a statement, "I want to personally congratulate and thank both the teams, Naughty Dog and Sucker Punch Productions, on their achievements. As we know, it's not an easy feat to reach the finish line under these circumstances. Both teams have worked hard to deliver world-class experiences, and we can't wait to see what you think of them when they release these in just a few short months. And finally, I want to thank the PlayStation community for their continuous support and patience. The Last of Us 2 takes place 5 years after the end of the dangerous journey across the post-pandemic United States. Ellie and Joel have settled down in Jackson, Wyoming, living amongst a thriving community of survivors that has offered them peace and stability despite the constant threat of the infected and other more desperate survivors. When a violent event interrupts that peace, Ellie embarks on a relentless journey to carry out justice and find closure. As she hunts those responsible one by one, she is confronted with the devastating physical and emotional repercussions of her actions."
Is it just a bunch of people screaming about face masks and being let outside to get their haircut?
I hope so. Dude, it's really, like, amazing what this has done to, like, shift the perspective of everybody's expectations for a global pandemic. Like, all of us expected zombies, and what did we get? Just social distancing and fucking face masks.
Yeah, no haircuts and no Applebee's. Sorry, guys.
Damn it.
This is, sorry about your dollar marks.
It was a new drink every month, Sam.
It's true. It's true. Fucking dollar margaritas. What a mistake that was, guys.
No, I don't even know what you're talking about. That was the best decision we ever made.
I just wanted to throw up from the amount of sugar.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Can I just have the tequila minus the marg?
Good Lord.
Okay, thanks.
So next up, Universal and AMC. Well, God, they're fucking beefing right now. Real bad.
Dude, it's still going on. It's still going on.
It's real bad. I love it. It's almost as bad as the fucking meltdown that Elon Musk has been having on Twitter over the past few days.
I was reading about that before we started recording today, and I'm so happy you mentioned that.
I was talking about it in real time as it was happening with Kelly. Like, I was like, you just tweeted that his girlfriend's mad at him. What's going on?
He wants to sell his house because it's one of his worldly possessions, but the stipulation is it can't be torn down because it's Gene Wilder's old home, and it must maintain Gene's soul.
I mean, that's fair.
I think that's a fair...
That's probably the smartest thing that Elon Musk has ever said.
That, and it's not a flamethrower.
So, much like Elon Musk's meltdown, Universal and AMC are facing a meltdown of their own sort. This is going to be a bit of a conversation starter, so we'll probably be on this topic for a while. Hollywood Reporter has released some very questionable news about the relationship between AMC, the world's largest movie theater chain, and NBC Universal, one of the top film companies in the world. According to recent financial calls made by NBC Universal, their recent animated family film Trolls World Tour racked up an estimated $100 million in premium VOD rentals in its first 3 weeks in North America, more than enough to put the film on the road to profitability. According to the conglomerate, that's not far behind the $16 million grossed by the original Trolls film in the first 3 weeks of its 2016 domestic box office release, which just topped out at apparently $153 million.
Damn.
Canada.
Dude, people love cartoons and Kelly Clarkson.
People love Trolls also. I mean, that's it's just a fact of life. So this caused Universal to... make a statement about the viability of VOD going forward. The results for Trolls World Tour have exceeded our expectations and demonstrated the viability of PVOD. Shell told the Wall Street Journal, which reported the numbers, as soon as theaters reopen, we expect to release movies on both formats. This really pissed off AMC.
Yeah, I'm fucking sure it did.
They released a scathing response. AMC Theaters chairman and CEO Adam Aron said Shell's comments were unacceptable. AMC is the largest circuit in the world. It's disappointing to us, but Jeff's comments to Universal's unilateral actions and intentions have left us with no choice. Therefore, effective immediately, AMC will no longer play any Universal movies in any of our theaters across the United States, Europe, or the Middle East. Drops microphone.
So before we get into the next part of his comment, I just want to compare this to like cutting off your nose to spite your face.
It is. This is
because he's literally.
Can I just say before you launch into this? This is a very Trump way of handling things.
You're right. Yeah,
but it's literally just like, oh, okay, so we're not gonna have the exclusive ability for your movie to play in our theaters because you're also going to release it on home formats at the same time. So instead of taking any possible money we could make by people who want to see this in the theater, fuck you. We're not going to take any money.
No money.
Haha, show you, bitch.
Yeah, we're taking none of your money. Idiots. I'll show you.
So they went on to state that this policy affects any and all Universal movies per se and goes into effect today as our theaters reopen, and it is not some sort of hollow or ill-considered threat, he continued.
It seems pretty ill-considered. I don't think they considered this idea enough. Right.
Incidentally, this policy is not aimed solely at Universal out of pique or to be punitive in any way. It also extends to any movie maker who unilaterally abandons current windowing practices absent good faith negotiations between us, so that they, as distributor and we as exhibitor, both benefit and neither are hurt from such changes. Currently, with the press comment today, Universal is the only studio contemplating a wholesale change to the status quo. Hence, this immediate communication in response.
It's literally taking your ball and going home, except you don't have a ball and your home burned
right.
down.
I was going to say, they don't even have a ball.
So there might be some horror fans out there that are pausing themselves and saying, oh, you know, that's great. You know, so what? A Trolls movie won't be shown in my theaters. Universal owns Blumhouse.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
God damn it.
This is bad.
But also, we here, at least in Richmond, I am less concerned because most of our theaters here in Richmond are not AMC.
Regal, bitch. True.
Yeah, we have Criterion and fucking
Regal.
Is Bowtie Regal?
Oh.
No, Bowtie's independent.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah. West Tower, yeah, that's Regal.
What's the one in Short Pump?
What about Cine oh, Bistro? Short Pump is Regal. Virginia Center Commons is Regal.
Short Pump doesn't give a shit.
No. They're like, whatever.
Or fucking Cine Bistro doesn't give a shit. They're not. They're just going to show it anyway. Like, they cater to a different class, though. Like, they aren't going to be, like, not a different class, but, like, a different clientele in terms of, like, what they're expecting. You know?
Right.
Like, yeah. So I don't think that would affect those kinds of things. But AMC, this is something that would definitely affect AMC, which, so I understand... Mm-hmm. why they took this response, but I think it was a little too spiteful.
It was.
Because now that, like, again, they're not getting anything
right.
from this now.
Right. And they can't renege this. Like, mm-mm. this isn't something that you can go back on.
They're like, oh, we thought about it. $5 million instead of $10 million is still $5 million more than if we don't show anything right. at all.
But I think it's telling that it actually didn't take long for Universal to respond. The studio issued an evening statement saying that it remains dedicated to moviegoing and that Shell's comments were misconstrued. The statement also took a dig at AMC and the National Association of Theater Owners, also called NATO for some weird fucking reason, for trying to confuse matters. We absolutely believe in the theatrical experience and have made no statement to the contrary. As we stated earlier, going forward, we expect to release future films directly to theaters, as well as on POVD or PVOD when the distribution method makes sense. We look forward to having additional private conversations with our exhibition partners, but are disappointed by this seemingly coordinated attempt from AMC and NATO to confuse our position and our actions. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. I mean, he makes a good point. He's saying right there that we're still giving them to the theaters. Yeah. We're just also going to release them PVOD, which I don't like that acronym at all.
Yeah, just call it VOD.
PVOD sounds like something for porn,
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like
no, that's what Palmer almost said. That's POVD.
Oh. point
of view demand.
It's when you can't get it up to any other kind of porn anymore.
So much of it.
I need it in 4K.
My 5G.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody needs porn in 4K.
So this leads us to the obvious question. Guys, are movie theaters dying? And is the movie theater experience something that will likely end within our lifetime? Or will at least become more niche than it is right now?
I see a lot more independent theaters like Bowtie popping up, especially... like the Criterion section of Bowtie, where it does all of those sort of more independent films, which I'm fine with.
I also see a potential rise in like movie theaters that are on a smaller scale. So none of these like 20 theater megaplexes, but like more stuff like Cinebistro, where it's like going to the movies as an event.
Yeah, you have dinner
and four like... event type movies.
But doesn't that cut out a lot of people who want to see movies though? Because going to Cinebistro,
it's expensive. It is prohibitively expensive.
I know, but if everyone else is eating, you can't bring a bunch of kids to a place where everyone is having popcorn and fucking.
It happens at the Marvel movies all the time.
Does it? Yeah. People just don't eat.
Yeah. People just get like popcorn.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You don't have to have like a full three course.
Yeah, you don't
meal.
Have to have a full. Just because we're fat.
Not everything is a date
like
night, even if you're with
me
friends.
In particular.
I mean, I see a cheesesteak. I got to eat the cheesesteak.
Exactly,
okay?
Dude. It's there. It's there. It's on the menu.
But I mean,
it
even,
has to happen.
I'm not going to eat the cheesesteak.
Even things like Criterion, I see potentially more of those popping up as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Or potentially more drive-ins. I know drive-ins are like kind of a relic in the movie theater industry, but you know,
it's actually interesting that you mentioned drive-ins, Sam, because I reached out to Goochland Drive-In Theater for comment on this.
Yeah.
They will respond. They said to give them a couple days, so we will continue this conversation probably as the bants for our next podcast.
I'm so happy that you reached out to them because I really do love Michelin Drive.
I do too. Like honestly, like we don't go there enough because it is a bit of a hike. But one of the big things that I asked them was, you know, especially considering they just opened up the second theater, mm-hmm. I asked them if they were going to entertain showing more niche films,
right?
In addition, and so we'll see what they say. We'll see what their responses are, and we'll kind of. Because I asked them specifically, what is their response to something like this? Well, do they think that PVOD will affect them personally? And then on top of that, you know, the idea of how they're going to compete in the future. Yeah, exactly. So we'll see what their response is. But I also read a lot of I'd say it's a rather well-trusted, occasionally controversial finance blog called The Motley Fool.
I read that.
They point me in the right direction every once in a while. But they posted some financial data that's kind of alarming about the history, or about the future, rather, of film going, I guess, the movie theater experience. Here's the excerpt. It's a bit difficult to see with just a quick glance the industry-wide numbers because they appear to be holding up. Last year's domestic box office receipts of $11.3 billion were down slightly from 2018's tally of $11.9 billion, according to data from Box Office Mojo, but 2018 was one heck of a record-breaking year.
Wasn't that the year that Endgame came out?
Yeah, yeah. There were a bunch. There were two successive, like, massive, because Black Panther came out, too.
Oh. Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
A closer look at the data, however, reveals that there's one curious detail. That is the industry's growth and almost entirely as a result of movie theater seats and higher ticket prices. The average total in ticket sales figure per movie per venue has been dwindling for years. They actually showed some interesting graphics that highlights their point to the letter, showing that average receipts per release are indeed going down. They then point out that data for tickets, which also appears to be declining, is happening as well, but it's at a slower rate. It's kind of tapering off. It seems to drop 1 year, kind of bounce back, but it's staying within around $60 million year in and year out, in terms of variation, I mean. So it's interesting. I guess the fact that theaters are constantly raising ticket prices, constantly trying to figure out ways to get more butts in seats, is what's keeping the industry alive rather than actual number, the volume of sales itself. The total number of tickets sold is even more alarming. The numbers, which tracks the movie industry data, reports that last year of 1.24 billion individual movie tickets sold in the United States was the second lowest number in years, extending a broad downtrend that first took shape back in 2001. So we're going on almost 20 years of downtrends. Ultimately, NBC Universal ended their response with the following. I would expect that consumers will return to the theaters and will be a part of that experience. I also expect that PVOD is going to be a part of that in some way. The flip side is the majority of our movies, whether we like it or not, are being consumed at home. It's not realistic to assume that we are not going to change. I think that's the big takeaway here.
Mm-hmm. Quarantine is dead. Long live quarantine.
Somebody cue up Blind Melon because we're definitely in for some change. Next up, we've got some Corona cancellations. We're going to add this to the ever-growing list of the pile. Lionsgate Antebellum had originally been set for a theatrical release back in April, but was bumped for obvious reasons. Antebellum is now going to be arriving on August 21st. They released a statement saying that by August 21st, audience will be eager for a distinctive, unique story and voice of these, I guess, groundmaking filmbreakers debut with Antebellum. I don't know if it's groundmaking or breaking. We'll see, I guess. I don't know.
No. You got to hype it up somehow.
You got to say something nice.
Thanks,
about
David
it.
Spitz. Antebellum stars Janelle Monáe as a successful author named Veronica Henley, who finds herself trapped in a horrifying reality and must uncover the mind-bending mystery before it's too late. There we go.
There we go.
Almost an hour into the podcast, and we just wrapped up the horror headlines. Guys, this is gonna be a doozy.
Well, we had a long section.
You know what? It's quarantine. I'm gonna talk for as damn long as I want.
Well, I've been letting these episodes because I guess for what, like, since we kind of kicked off the year, I've been trying to keep them under 90 minutes.
Under, yeah.
But since quarantine happened, I figured, you know, people need their entertainment. Even though our listenership has dropped off the face of a fucking cliff. I think it's because...
I feel like a lot of people aren't in the car.
Yeah, that's what I kind of chalked up to.
I'm super backed up on all of my podcasts because now I only listen to them when I mow the lawn.
You mow the lawn, what?
Yeah.
Once a week.
Oh, you mow your lawn once a week?
Well, I try to,
at least. Fancy pants.
I mow my lawn once a week.
You've seen my lawn? That shit gets way too big.
Yeah, you got that freshy lawn. I was going to make some really inappropriate joke, but I'm glad that I didn't.
Yo, bush thick.
Yo, bush thick. No.
Sam, we got anything on the Nassling list?
Yeah, we do. We got zombies, ghosts, and home invasions this week.
All right, let's get into it. Sam, what do we have on the list?
All right, so kicking it off on Shudder this week on the 28th, we got Blood Quantum. The dead are coming back to life outside.
So fucking good. Yes.
Really? So yes. You already watched this. Okay.
Yes. Very good. Highly recommend.
All right, so the dead are coming back to life outside the isolated Mi'kmaq reserve of Red Crow, except for its indigenous inhabitants who are immune to the zombie plague. Trailer, the tribal sheriff... must protect his son's pregnant girlfriend, apocalyptic refugees, and reserve riffraff from the hordes of walking white corpses. I feel like I heard about this movie like a long time ago. Either that, or there were multiple movies that came out in regards to Mi'kmaq.
Right?
No, we talked about this one on the podcast at one point. When I think it went through Fantastic Fest or something, and then Shudder picked it up, and I think we discussed it.
That's probably right.
Is it on Shudder?
It is on Shudder.
It is.
They surprised released this.
It came out on Tuesday.
Surprise. So I watched it. I'm not really sure what I went in to expect. It was almost like one of those Train to Busan moments. Mm-hmm. Don't expect the emotional level of Train to Busan. But it's one of those you tune in expecting it to be kind of like a standard zombie flick, and you're not really your expectations aren't that high. I walked away enjoying the hell out of this movie.
Hell yeah.
I really thought it was great.
Hell yeah. Does the name make sense? The name of the movie, Blood Quantum? That's a strange title for a zombie-ish film.
I mean, I get it. Does it does? Yeah, it's. I think it's just a badass name.
Fair enough. Next up, we got The Wretched, which comes out on May 1st on VOD from IFC Midnight. Following his parents' separation, a rebellious teenage boy named Ben is sent to live with his father for the summer and work at the local marina in order to gain some form of discipline. The tourist town offers little solace for him, however, as he is forced to deal with the local privileged teens and his father's new girlfriend. Ben's problems grow increasingly disturbing when he makes a chilling discovery about the family renting the house next door, and a malevolent spirit from the woods has taken a hold of the parents and starts playing a sinister game of house, preying upon the children and wiping away any trace of their existence. Ben's suspicions of the supernatural horrors go unheeded, and he launches a perilous crusade in order to put an end to the skinwalking witch's reign of terror.
Dun, dun, dun.
The image search for this movie, it actually looks kind of good. The production value looks pretty on point.
Yeah, the trailer looks solid on this one. I just need to track it down and see how much this one costs, because this would be one of those PVOD moments.
Pavod.
And finally this week, we've got a movie called Get In, which is obviously
got to
be the opposite of Get Out. Get in, bitches. We're going to the mall.
To be screened immediately after Get Out.
Yes. Or immediately before.
And then after Get Hard.
Came out May 1st on Netflix. Jesus Christ. Paul Diallo, a history teacher, lives a quiet life with his wife and kid. During summertime, he lends his house to his son's babysitter and her boyfriend. When they return, the Diallo family finds a closed door, locks have been changed, and the new occupants maintain they are in their home. With no one to turn to, Paul gets closer to Mickey, a shady local man with a penchant for all things extreme and illegal, and soon, the once anti-violent teacher is approaching the point of no return. It is a French film on Netflix, so I'm guessing it's probably going to be better than the English horror movies that they release. It's also known as Get In or Die Trying, and also as Fury. And supposedly is based on a true story, but I've not been able to find anything that actually corroborates that.
All right. Speaking of Netflix films, have you guys had a chance to watch The Platform yet?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's also worth a watch.
Okay. Yeah, we talked about that.
We talked about that last week.
We did, because there was a movie that was seemed rather similar.
Yeah, it was very cube-like.
Okay.
That was the biggest takeaway that I had, but it was good. It was good. For a Netflix horror film, I was surprisingly impressed.
Mm-hmm. When Ben watched it, I don't think it was his favorite, but he said that he thought that I would really like it. So,
like, yeah. It's good. Yeah. I wouldn't mind talking about it on the podcast somewhere down the road. There's a few themes that it would make sense with.
I feel like maybe one month we should have a Netflix horror theme.
I'd be down for that. We'll watch
our own Netflix and Kill.
So good.
We'll watch terrible house sale movie.
Open house.
Yeah.
Don't make me watch it again.
Yeah.
2018's worst horror movie of the year, I believe.
Was it 18? Was it really only 18?
Yeah.
God damn.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm young, apparently. I thought it was like 2016, 2015.
It might have been 2017, and that's what you guys talked about at the start of 2018.
Okay. Oh, maybe. Maybe that's what it was.
Whatever.
That wraps it up, huh?
No, that movie should be fired off into the sun.
Is there anything else on this? No, that's it.
Yeah. No, that's it for this week.
The script. Yeah, it's time for the main event. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's main event.
All right, this week's main event, We Summon the Darkness, came out this year. Well, last year at Fantastic Fest, but this year for the plebeian public like ourselves. It's directed by Mark Myers. It's written by Alan Trezza. It stars Alexandra Daddario as Alexis, Kian Johnson as Mark, Maddie Hassan as Val, Amy Forsyth as Beverly, Logan Miller as Kovacs, Austin Swift as Ivan, Johnny Knoxville as John Henry Butler, and Allison McCatty as Susan. I don't know what to say about this. There's another fucking 80s era film that relives the satanic panic. What fun!
Hurrah!
Hurrah! Look, you guys. This time it includes heavy metal, though, so, you know, sweet. Screenwriter Alan Trezza seems to be kind of the cement for this film. His past history with Alexander Daddario and Bury Your Ex caused her to be interested in the script, and his work with director Mark Myers on My Friend Dahmer brought the camera talent towards the project as well. After some blanket financing, the film was greenlit and realized in a short time frame. Mark Myers, he's an interesting director. I've only seen his previous film, My Friend Dahmer, but I admit that his material has me intrigued enough to kind of check out some of his back catalog, as sparse as it might be right now. I think he only has, three other films to his name, not including My Friend Dahmer. I think it's three other films.
I think it is three.
Yeah. So We Summon the Darkness, I did not think that it was his strongest work. I'm just going to put that out there right now, which is kind of surprising considering Alan Trezza's past script writing, which has actually been quite good. You'd think this duo would have really knocked it out of the park when paired with the acting talent that they had around him. But unfortunately, I thought My Friend Dahmer kind of was leaps and bounds ahead of what this film ultimately ended up being. Not to say that it wasn't a fun ride. I did enjoy it for what it was. I don't think it was at all awful. I actually think that it was a pretty great way to kick off our month of heavy metal horror, aka metal madness, aka ripping riffs, aka horrific headbanging. Look, guys, I can go all day with this.
Please do. Like we already established, there's no cutoff for the quarantine podcast time limit. So,
but I left my initial viewing kind of disappointed. It uses a bit of subversion to kind of play with the viewer's expectations, starting out at the very beginning, in the way that reminds me a lot of another film that we've covered here before on the podcast called Better Watch Out. I don't think that it does so quite as successfully, but there is a good attempt here, which is commendable.
Yeah, Better Watch Out's a really good call. I got a lot of Double Date vibes from this while I was watching it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't get that at all while I was watching. Like, that didn't pop into my brain as I was watching it, but that as soon as you mentioned it, I was just like, yes, 100%.
I think the I didn't even think of Better Watch Out until I saw you had mentioned it. I think the reason is because I probably watched Double Date more recently than Better Watch Out.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I remember really liking Better Watch Out, and kind of finding myself comparing that movie to this film a lot throughout the course of it, because it kind of follows a very similar plot structure. It really tries to kind of like lead you astray as a viewer for a little while. And then finally, when it throws the twist in, like the stick in the spokes and twists everything around, I just feel like it did that much more successfully than this did. But premiering at Fantastic Fest back in 2019 for the first time, We Summon the Darkness has been generating a fair bit of hype for a more low-key release. This wasn't even going to get, like, well, I guess it was going to get a national release, but it was limited, you know, up until Corona had something to say about that. But with Texas Chainsaw 3D star Alexander Daddario at the helm of the film, it created some excitement that just... generated, I guess, based on her being involved. She's eye candy. She's kind of established herself as a, not just a good act. She's a lot. She reminds me a lot of Barbara Crampton, in the sense that she's actually a really good actress, but she's really pretty to look at, and she's already started kind of doing more and more genre films.
She's definitely carved out a space for herself.
Yeah. And I don't mean that like in a belittling way, any way, shape, or form. It's just like what she's chosen as a path for an actress. I strongly believe she could do Oscar-worthy stuff if she wanted to, but I appreciate the fact that she's appearing in more of these like low-key, like B-movie type of horror films. I really appreciate that.
She's also gotten into producing.
Oh.
Yeah, she has.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like she bounces kind of like she does one of these and then she does a rom-com and then does one of these and then does a rom-com. So it's interesting. I feel like she could do other stuff if she really wanted to, but I have no problem seeing her in tons of horror movies. She seems to really enjoy it, which is really all that matters. So it kind of generated some excitement just based on the fact that she was involved in this, but the script setting is really what seemed to kind of keep the hype train's momentum moving. I know we talked about this a lot, getting ready to build up towards its release. I was really fascinated just kind of based on the fact that some of the other casting choices were involved, but I came for the casting choices and stayed for the story.
There you go. That's not too bad.
Exactly, but it comes complete with a cast of young actors that are all no strangers to horror and genre films. Amy Forsyth has been in the second season of Channel Zero and the recent Hellfest, which came out back in 2018, which, if you guys will remember, is about the amusement park has the serial killer inside of it. Maddie Hassan also starred in the 2011 black comedy God Bless America by Bobcat Goldthwait, which I definitely... would say is a genre film. It would not appeal to everybody. Kenan Johnson made his appearance in Alita Battle Angel, and obviously Alexander Daddario is no stranger starring in numerous horror and thriller films. This movie really set out to play with viewers' expectations and kind of be a love letter to heavy metal itself all at the same time, while capitalizing on the recent popularity of 80s set pieces. But while this film is a period piece, I don't feel like it felt like one when you watched it. Did you guys get that?
Yeah, I struggled with what timeline this actually took place in until they started talking about, you know, bands and, you know, who had died when and who was joining groups when.
Right. The part that got me was, so, like, when they were pulling up to the concert and you saw, like, all these old muscle cars from, like, the 70s and early 80s, I was just like, okay, that's weird. And then when they started talking about, like, whose first concert was what, and I think it was Maddie... or it might have been Amy Forsyth. But one of them was like, yeah, this was my first concert in 1983. And I was just like, when the fuck is this movie taking place?
Yeah, they didn't. I don't think they did a good job of transporting you to the time that like, it was supposed to take place.
None of these girls look like they're in their 50s.
Right. And I mean, aside from what, like, some of the food products, the packaging on the food products scattered throughout
the film.
There
was, like, an emphasis on the Twinkies.
Yeah, and, like, a few of the other things that they purchased, like... there's not really a whole lot that kind of makes this an 80s film.
No. It really does.
But that's, I don't mean that as kind of like a jab at it. I think it
I don't know. I think
it may not necessarily be a negative.
Well, if you're going to do a movie that's set in the 80s, I feel like people should feel like they're in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's kind of the charm of these nostalgic films, right? And that did not have that.
That's true.
Like, especially if you're playing with the satanic panic instead of just like, oh, it's just some cult.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. But I feel like for us personally as a podcast, the big attention grabber was actually the inclusion of none other than Johnny Knoxville. I remember when we first started talking about this movie in our horror headlines about a year ago, when we were all collectively surprised to hear his name announced alongside the rest of the cast. I really don't think he's a bad actor in his own right, but his performance in this, at least to me, felt phoned in while in this role as Pastor John Henry Butler. He's not sinister enough or present enough to be more than a passing blow throughout the course of the film, but considering the way the character is written, that may have actually been the intention. Knoxville's character is kind of lurking in the background, pulling the strings, and he's the one left to clean up the mess and kind of tailor the story of what the events were in whatever way benefits him. He's selfish, he's conceited, he's uncaring, but his character never really comes across as evil enough to really sell any of this, at least to me, like I said. Think about it. If you actually compare his performance to something like Michael Parks's performance as Pastor Cooper in Red State or Michael Sheen's role in Apostle, then it becomes really apparent that maybe Knoxville would have benefited from a better written role. Maybe better direction, maybe both. I don't know. He felt pretty flat to me when I saw him on screen.
Yeah. I would have to agree.
So I want to jump into his defense real quick, because I do think it's more the writing, because his role has him on screen for, what, about 5 minutes?
I was going to say, yeah, 6-7 minutes maybe.
Whereas, like, Parks and Sheen have, like, really dominant roles in their movies, and Knoxville's not really in this one. Like, he's, aside from him being on the TV in the gas station in the opening, he really doesn't show up until like the last like 20 minutes of the movie. And even then he's not on screen for the majority
but
of it.
Did you not feel like even those sermons he's giving from the TV pulpit that he is on, while he's got like his national audience on TV, like, did you not feel like they didn't have enough like fire and brimstone?
Yeah, there definitely wasn't enough for that. The part of his that I really liked though is like when he confronts the guy outside, and then when he first walks in to confront Alexis before all of that goes sideways, like,
oh, when he shoots the kid, you mean? Like the
Shoots the kid, and when he first confronts Alexis, like his demeanor and just kind of like the way he's carrying himself, like, I think that sold it really well. I think after the confrontation with Alexis goes sideways, I think I was just like, this doesn't really work for me.
Right.
I think using his character as sort of like an element of surprise, you know, at the end and having him not be present in a lot of the movie kind of took away from whatever his character was supposed to bring.
Yeah. I just, we'll talk about it a little bit more in depth here in a little bit, but there was supposed to be a much more elaborate third act to this film.
Okay.
I really kind of want to see what that entailed. I do, because like it really does fall apart in the last third of the film. I feel like it's reaching its stride, and then it like gets to this point where there's this awkward tension, and then it just doesn't capitalize on what it builds up to. I don't know. It's interesting. Part of the flatness of this film might have stemmed from the fact that Myers may have bitten off a little more than he could chew. Filming We Summon the Darkness alongside another film called Human Capital, which released back in 2019 as well. It's a shame, honestly, because I really did have some higher expectations for this film, especially after as much as I enjoyed My Friend Dahmer. The film's original script had a number of changes made to it, including the fact that Allison McCaddy's character Susan was supposed to be Alexis's biological mother, a plot point that was supposed to be a key moment of a much more elaborate third act of the film. I've seen this cited in a couple other blogs and tidbits I've read about the film as well, but I couldn't pinpoint exactly what those details were. Seems like everybody that I came across, all the information that I came across, was talking about how this was supposed to have a build up to a much more broad third act, but didn't quite end up getting there. As a result, I don't know, this may or not have been due to the fact that Myers was directing another film. That's just speculation on my part. It could have actually easily been any number of issues. Well, maybe there wasn't enough financing for it. Maybe the budget, maybe they just ran out of the budget. I don't know. Yeah. My speculation is that he maybe, you know, divided himself a little too thin between the two projects. But
that's fair.
It is what it is. Synopsis, let's start off with that. In Indiana in July 1988, Alexis Butler and her two friends Val and Bev are driving to a heavy metal festival. Val is unable to hold her weak bladder. And the trio have to stop at a gas station, appearing out of place in their Lord Lucifer battle vests and patch-covered attire. During this gas station scene, we actually get our first glimpse at Johnny Knoxville's character, John Henry Butler, as he waxes poetic about the evils of heavy metal music. When the girls get back in their car and they resume driving, an ominous newsflash comes up on the radio. The three girls turn it up and listen in awe as the radio describes a series of satanic occult murders that have been taking place throughout the Midwest. The body count currently stands at 18, with the latest group of murders being a trio of family members that were slaughtered and covered in satanic symbols before being burned. Something that coincidentally loosely resembles recent events that took place in Canada. Am I the only one that picked up on that?
Yes. What?
So, did you not hear about this? So there was a serial killer that was going through Canada killing victims. That's why they just banned all automatic rifles as a result of this serial killer.
Oh, the thing that happened in Nova Scotia.
Yeah. So like this guy was going from
I didn't know that had ties to like Satanism.
No, it didn't. This guy was going from house to house killing family members and then setting the houses ablaze, which is exactly what's going on in this film.
Okay.
That's where I picked up on the I don't know, coincidental loose ties to what's going on in reality right now.
Art.
Yeah, I guess so.
Life is art.
The tension is broken when a milkshake is thrown from a blue van onto their windshield by a group of reckless teen hooligans.
Hooligans! So this happened to me in high school, actually.
It was
teen
me,
hooligans threw a chocolate milkshake on your windshield?
They did, and those teen hooligans, though, were actually my friends. I don't remember where we were driving from. I know we were driving through Short Pump at the time, and we pulled up to a stoplight, and when the light turned green, my friends who were in the car next to me, like, took off real fast, and as I was kind of, like, pulling up to them, they chucked a milkshake out their window at my windshield.
Nice. Did you deserve
that? That shit will ruin the fucking gloss on your paint. I would be so fucking mad. I would fucking hunt them down, dude. I would fucking...
I didn't really have to hunt them down. They were
That would be the event that triggered me into becoming a serial killer.
So, today I learned... throw a milkshake on Palmer's Jeep and we'll find out if he's actually a serial killer or not.
God, I will fucking like lose. I had somebody leave a piece of ham on the roof of my car one day.
Shit, fuck your paint.
Yeah, dude.
I did that to a buddy of mine in high school, actually. We left polka dots all over his car by putting some like bologna and ham lunch meats on the side of his car.
Wait, I'm sorry. So are you guys saying that in high school your cars were actually shiny?
No, our cars were shit.
Car was a piece of shit.
I drove a Pontiac Grand Prix, a 1994 Pontiac Grand Prix at the time.
Yeah. You could have covered my car in bologna and mustard, and literally you wouldn't even notice.
The car that I was driving at the time was a 1987 Ford Bronco II that didn't have a top coat, so it was just like a flat red.
Like a matte. Yeah, mine was a Toyota Tercel.
So then yours really got rusted.
Yeah.
No, this one just took like the enamel off my paint job, and like it was like one dull circle amidst a sea of shine. I'll never forget it, fuckers. I don't know, those hijinks. When I think about that kind of shit that we like did or got away with or had happened to us in high school.
Dude, I'm thinking,
now, fucking Jesus Christ, dude. I'd be appearing on the top of fight porn, dude. Like, our fight porn would just be like, this guy pulled over and beat the shit out of somebody because they dumped a milkshake on their car. I can't say I've ever had that one happen to me, Sam, but I'm glad you've experienced it. Somebody channeled this moment.
I went to a midnight movie at the Bird once, not long after the milkshake incident, and somebody else
took like a mixture of like the chili and cheese you get from 7-Eleven, and they put it under my windshield wiper blade and under my door handles.
Hell yeah!
And then like smeared a bunch like in a couple of other places. And this is like December or January, so it's freezing outside. So it all like froze and solidified, except when I turned on the defroster on my windshield, it loosened it up on the windshield wiper blades and smeared it everywhere.
Nice. Oh, sounds like people thought you were kind of a dick.
Yeah, dude.
Apparently.
Yeah.
I just stick hot dogs on people's antenna.
See, that's cute.
That's a Ben and Alex specialty.
That's harmless.
Because people don't notice it for like quite a while, and they're driving around with hot dogs on their antenna.
After pulling off to clean up their Jeep, and in Val's case, take another leak. Seriously, she really needs to get that checked out.
Is she pregnant or something?
Yeah, right. It's a condition. She's obviously had it checked out.
There's always one girl on the road trip who has to pee all the time.
Yeah, it's called fucking prostate cancer. Like, get that shit checked, dude. Like, I don't know. Like, can girls even get prostate? Girls have
prostate? Girls don't have prostates?
Hold on. Do women have prostates?
Failing of our educational system.
Women do not have prostates. They have a series of glands and ducts at the front of the vagina called the skene glands. I don't know, which are sometimes referred to as the female prostate.
So women don't have a prostate in the sense of a male prostate, but they have glands that are similar to.
Yes.
Congratulations to everybody who listens to our episodes. You are now officially a doctor in the modern United States of America.
The more you know, Star Rainbow.
Yeah, exactly. They arrive at the concert and they find the same blue van, and Val throws a small firecracker into it, causing the three boys inside to climb out. Ivan owns the van, and his buddies, Kovacs and Mark, who is said to be leaving for Los Angeles soon, are all interested in the girls. After blowing off some steam and warming up to each other, the two groups begin to talk heavy metal culture and the recent satanic murders, where it's revealed that each murder was done in threes. Just for fun, just for shits and giggles, I decided to take a look at the occult meaning behind the number three and dug up some interesting facts. Aside from the standard Holy Trinity and whatnot that appears in Christian context, the number three has a ton of different occult meanings and appears in many different religions and mythologies in regards to hell. It is the first odd number, not including one,
it's the second odd number.
It's the first odd number that's divisible by itself and one.
Okay.
Technically, the same could be said for one, where one is itself and it is divisible by one.
All right. You fucking
shenanigans.
All right. It's wholly unique unto itself and cannot be divided by anything except three parts of its whole, i.e., one. This number is associated with strength, physicality, and self-reliance, a key tenet of a lot of sects of Satanism. Self-reliance, culling the weak, etc., all loosely associated with that, I don't know, sect of religion. Is it a religion? Yeah, I guess so.
Satanism?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it is.
As much as the flying spaghetti monster is.
Yeah, I guess so. It's the reconciliation of all paradoxes as well. The idea that in creation, 1 + 1 = 3, this one is particularly confusing to me, but the loose gist of what I could understand of it is that no one knows what sparked creation, and that the only light of truth is revealed by the knowledge of what that source of the other one is. And I guess that's the paradox of creation. That nobody knows that they're what the other one is. So as everybody's concerned, as far as everybody's concerned, 1 + 1 = 3. Because it's a man, it's a man and a woman that creates more life, right?
Yeah. Right. Okay, right.
But then who created man and woman? So there has to be that extra one.
Okay.
I've also seen it used against abortion in the sense of like one and one, as you said, creates the third life.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those bizarre things. Satan's also supposed to be the light bringer, so I guess he's the one that sheds light on what the truth of the other one is. I don't know. That seemed grabbing to me. I really didn't understand a lot of how this there was an article that I came across that related the number three to the occult. And then there was another one that I found that related it to Satanism in specific. I tried to latch onto the Satanism one a little bit more because of the context of this film. I ended up walking away very confused.
That'll happen. A big part of it, though, is just like the idea of triplets. So if you go back and, you know, look at the Old Testament, the New Testament, any of it, really, the number three is tied predominantly to the idea of completeness. And three and seven have the shared idea of completeness, whereas six, the number six, is considered incomplete or weak. So when you have like three sixes together, it's, you know, completely incomplete or completely weak, which is kind of how it was positioned as the idea behind Satan. But also, when you use triplets, it's to describe the intensity of something. So, you know, I remember specifically, like, you know, growing up, there are a lot of services where you'll say the same word three times in a row,
right?
To really describe the intensity of whatever that word is. And then once you get into Revelations, you see the evil trinity, where you've got the triplet of Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet. Having the murders all take place in threes kind of reinforces that idea of, like, the seriousness of these deaths. So, weird little things. But again, most of it doesn't really make sense, which is why people spend their entire lifetimes trying to study this shit and understand it.
Well, didn't Jesus come back after 3 days, right? And they say that the devil is supposed to take the three and use it against Christians in, like, a mocking tone, right? Mm-hmm. As a way to, like, sort of mock Jesus and Christianity, is to come back and use the three against them.
Well, if there's anything that I've learned from William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, it is that the devil will cease at nothing to blaspheme anything related to Christ.
Blaspheme. I feel like, yes, blaspheme is the word I was looking for.
So I think ultimately the biggest takeaway is that three represents the foundation of stability. A bicycle can topple over easily because it only has two wheels, but adding a third wheel creates a much more stable base. So I guess this is supposed to be the stability of, like, yeah, it's a tricycle. But I think the idea is that adding a third wheel is what makes it stable. So I guess it's supposed to also have to be like the stability of the occult and the ability, I guess, of Satan. I don't know, dude. This is so far. I am not a scholar.
You are a gentleman, but not a scholar, Palmer. You tried, though. A for effort.
Yeah, I really did. All right, so the two groups decide that they like each other after all, and they decide to go in and check out the show. I want to pause here for a second and admire this dude's falsetto. The vocalist of this band that he's just embracing, dude. He's fucking riffing, dude. Just fucking go for it. Yeah!
80s Danish hair metal, man. Right. All hail merciful fate.
For sure. After the show, Alexis invites the boys to her father's empty mansion. So at this point, we have no idea who her father is, what he does, or how he's amassed such a sheer amount of wealth, because this is very clearly not an 80s house. Not only does this man have a massive amount of wealth, he has enough wealth to transport them to 2020.
I mean, he's got a future home. It's the world of tomorrow.
It's the world of tomorrow. Fucking Futurama, man. So they get over to this place. All the boys are like, yo, what's the deal?
What's going on here?
What's going on here? You know, they're in awe of this home. I mean, wouldn't you be?
How did we get so lucky?
Exactly. Wouldn't you be if you just met this random group of girls? You're like, oh, dude, these are some cute heavy metal chicks. We're ready to go back to their place, blah, blah, blah. You walk in. It's a fucking mansion. You're just like, what have we stumbled onto? This is the jackpot right here. So they're all enjoying themselves. They're having a few drinks. Over the course of the night, the two groups have a few beverages. They exchange stories, and they begin to delve into their love of metal. And I think that this right here happens to be one of the best parts of the film, and something that really reveals just how much the writers of the script know their metal culture. Every single time you get a bunch of metalheads together, the immediate result is a dick measuring contest over fandom and knowledge, which is exactly what we watch unfold over the next few minutes as the two groups discuss everything from Dio to Metallica. A lot of why this felt so organic might have actually come down to the casting. In an interview with Ain't It Cool, Myers stated that Logan Miller is actually a metalhead. I met him a few years prior when I was casting Dahmer, and he's the first guy we reached out to play Kovacs. I think it really shines through in terms of like scenes like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know that I think that he's a particularly great actor, if I'm totally honest. But when it comes to scenes about talking about metal and living through metal culture, it came across as very organic. Whereas a lot of the other scenes that take place later in the film came across as kind of forced. Metalheads are a really passionate bunch. So it probably helps a lot when trying to capture that passion when the people who are involved in capturing said passion are actually fans of the genre. I feel like that really helped a lot in terms of kind of progressing this scene forward and the actual meeting of the two groups. And
it did seem very organic.
It did. It really did. Bev and Mark seemed to like each other quite a bit. Actually, yet Bev seems to almost avoid him as they play a game of Never Have I Ever, which I actually don't think I've played since we were in high school.
Do you think that game was around in the 80s?
Yeah, right. Like it's got to be as old as Spin the Bottle, right?
You think so? I don't know. For some reason, when they started playing Never Have I Ever, I got this like twinge of... Was that even a game? But why would it not be?
Yeah, but I feel like it's got to have been around at that point, right? When was
it's
Never...
the first time that I've ever seen Never Have I Ever been played in like an 80s movie?
Yeah.
It is, you're right. It's always Spin the Bottle.
Yeah, it's true.
But that doesn't... Spin the Bottle doesn't really...
Or just some generic truth or dare.
Yeah, it doesn't really create character, you know, depth and story progression as much as Never Have I Ever does.
Yeah, they did actually a pretty good job of kind of creating that story progression and character development, like you said, like with this, right? Because we learned that there's actually like a lot of resentment towards, what's the kid's name? Kovacs, right?
Mm-hmm. For going to Los Angeles.
Yeah, for going to LA or getting ready to go to LA. That there's actually like a good amount of camaraderie between the three guys. I feel like we learn more about the three guys than we do about the three girls. We get a little bit
on purpose, right?
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Keep that under wraps for the girls at this point.
I feel like we learn more about the girls during their journey to the metal show, and we learn more about the guys during the Never Have I Ever scene. Which makes sense in terms of.
And I have to give them props for there is good character development in a very short amount of time for both of the groups of characters, which I do think is good.
There is. And like, I think that's kind of the problem, right, with this film is like, I really did enjoy like the first like two acts of this film. Yes. So if we call this like a 4-part play, the first two acts are really, really well done. You've got solid character development. You feel like, by the closure of the first half of the film, you really know these characters, right? Yeah. Or at least you're led to believe that you really know these characters. So right. When it does shift everything on its head here in the act we're about to talk about, I feel like there could have been so much more potential with the way that they explore these things that it's just never realized. I don't know. They play this Never Have I Ever game, but it's during the course of this game that the girls drop a bomb on the boys. They've drugged the drinks. And not only that, they casually bring up that they're going to kill him.
Yeah, they say that straight up.
Straight up. And it's kind of brought up like it's maybe a joke. And so the boys are all like, oh, you're just fooling, blah, blah, blah. And then one of them passes out. And then
you
another one
need
passes
to drug
out.
Us to fuck us.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And another one passes out. And then all of a sudden it's lights out across the board. And these boys wake up in literally a fight for their lives. They're next on the chopping block. The Daughters of the Dawn, the church the girls are a part of, has murdered 18 other people in the same way in order to create fear and send more people towards their religion. Alexis is sure to be the most insane of these girls, and she stabs Ivan after criticizing after he criticizes her religious beliefs in Christ, and he bleeds to death.
And specifically the thing that drives her over the edge, which is kind of an early reveal, is when he starts criticizing the pastor.
Right. Right. And we don't quite know at this point that that's her dad. But it's definitely building up to that, right?
Nobody says Jack. Nobody says mean shit about your cult leader. You don't let them get away with that.
You're right.
It doesn't matter if they're your dad or not.
You're right.
Stand up for him.
Mm-hmm. So I would die for him.
A little piece of me died with him because that was my character, dude. I was like, dude, he's a tall, fat guy who's really into metal. I identify with this man.
You were the first to die.
I just wanted his van.
He did have that dope van.
Yeah, he did have the dope van. So a little piece of me died when he died. I was very sad that he was brought out of the film like that. You know, just more examples of the discrimination that takes place on a daily basis against tall, large men. Moving on.
Such a difficult world you live in.
I feel so sorry for you.
Ceilings aren't high enough. You know, just clothes don't fit right.
Chairs aren't big enough.
Chairs aren't big enough. Nothing makes sense in my shallow, twisted world. Mark and Kovacs.
And now I'm going to be a serial killer.
Yeah, exactly. This is just another step towards me just stabbing everybody.
He's gonna fucking kill
someone. Mark and Kovacs, they briefly escape, and the two boys hide in, of all places, a pantry.
Right. At least they're not going to run out of food, and that's a big-ass pantry,
too. That is true. Susan, Alexis's soon-to-be ex-stepmother, she comes home to retrieve her passport. And reveals that she has called the police because she saw a strange blue van and house lights in a house that's supposed to be empty at this point, right?
Yeah. Well, let's be real. She came back to get her passport and snort like 6 rails of coke.
Oh, yeah, dude. Take one look
she
at her.
She needed some cash. She needed her passport. She needed some pre-travel party goods.
Right.
And by that, I mean balloons of cocaine.
Yeah. She could be God using them that are already her butt.
Ass for when she was taking them.
So Susan, she does a quick kind of scan of the house. She's like, you're fucking lying to me right now. What the fuck are you wearing? What's going on here? You need to tell me the truth right now. And as she's kind of lecturing her soon-to-be ex-stepdaughter, she stumbles upon the body of...
Or Palmer.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. She stumbles R.I.P. upon my corpse. And this causes Alexis to stab her to death.
That's fair.
So just like that, two people's lives are just snuffed out like a candle.
I do appreciate,
in the
though, how they're like, just walk away. Like when she finally figures out that everything is awry and shit's going down, they gave her an out. They're like, I don't want to do this. Like, just fucking mind your own business. And she was all coked out and wouldn't drop it.
So it leaves one question, you guys.
What's that?
Can beauty come out of ashes?
Oh my God.
Callback.
Yes, it can.
So because she called the police, because Susan, the stepmother, called the police. Police officer arrives, and he, as police officers are apt to do, becomes suspicious of the situation.
He's not taking any shit.
He's really not.
She
he's
said
really
the word not. Like about 47 times.
In that but time. I think she was doing that on purpose, right? So she's trying to play up her like dumb.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah. Girl.
Like her teehee. I'm pretty. Just listen to me, and let's call it. You know. Yeah. At that.
And it didn't work.
It didn't work at all. I'm noticing a trend, actually, with her ability to be able to get people to just walk away from this situation. It's just not working
for
her.
She can't do it.
Also, I don't need to show you my ID. I know my rights when you're here for potential, like...
B&E.
Yeah, B&E. Yeah, you obviously don't know your rights.
No. Straight from, like, just having a tantrum.
Yeah, right. This is entitled White Girl at its apex, dude. So.
Okay, Karen, do you want me to get my manager?
Can I talk to your manager?
So Alexis runs from him because that's the only reasonable solution. And back into the house where he chases her, gun raised. The officer finds the injured Kovacs and Mark, who pleads for help, but Val sneaks up behind him, takes his gun, and shoots him point blank. Yep. Just fucking killing him. And then proceeds to shoot like 3 more shots into the pantry, just wasting bullets. Alexis and Val fight over the gun, and Bev appears, threatening her friends with what looked like it could possibly be the propeller of a boat.
Yeah, it's an outboard motor.
Okay,
yeah.
It took me forever to figure out what the fuck she was holding.
Yeah, it's an outboard motor.
Val,
those things are fucking heavy, so good on her for carrying that thing around.
Yeah. Val and Alexis tell Bev that they're doing the Lord's work, and Bev declares that she will let Mark and Kovacs go. Bev tries to help Mark and Kovacs, the latter of who is bleeding out and won't last much longer unless he gets to a hospital. Alexis has the car keys, so Mark goes after her to retrieve them. But when Kovacs sees car lights, he goes outside, struggling to walk, to find John Henry Butler, played by Johnny Knoxville, who's turns out to be Alexis's father and is the pastor of the Daughters of the Dawn. Mark gets the keys, but Alexis attacks him, and they fight. Val attacks Bev and tries to kill her, but Bev lights Val on fire.
That was amazing.
Her hair being full of hairspray, as if hair wasn't flammable enough. The hairspray really just adds a whole other element to it.
And well, your hair will singe. Your hair will singe and burn, but it's not going to go up in flames like this.
And throughout the whole movie, right, you're seeing her constantly reapplying this hairspray. Yeah. And I feel like that was such a good... Yeah. When she finally got lit on fire, like, haha, all that hairspray. Good tie-in.
What
good
they call it, Aqua Velva or whatever?
I think it's Aquanet, yeah.
Aquanet, yeah, that's it.
That's
fucking Aquanet, dude.
Was Aquanet.
That's that 99-cent jinx.
Her fucking just helmet of gray hair that never moved.
You right.
Butler attacks Kovacs off-screen, and he makes it back to the house where Bev finds him. Just before Kovacs dies, he tells Bev to save Mark. Butler shoots Mark as he's strangling Alexis, but then berates his daughter for doing a terrible job of murdering and covering it up. He's basically just like, you did the one thing that I asked you to do completely wrong.
And so like,
why
that
the
part...
fuck do I love you? Get out of my life.
You are garbage.
So like that sequence though with him, I think he did really well.
Mm-hmm.
It's when he puts his hands on her in the very next part where I think it all just falls apart.
Yeah, I'd agree. Where was I?
Here.
He tells Alexis that they need to make some sacrifices.
Right. All right. So he tells Alexis they need to make some sacrifices. Hold on. We're going to pause.
Are we paused right now?
No.
Can I go grab something really quick?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The mountains are blue.
Hell yeah. Alright. 10 seconds and we're ready to roll. Alright, so after all this goes on, he basically tells Alexis, they've got to make some sacrifices. They got to get some shit done in order to recover from what has taken place.
She's got to be a martyr.
Yeah, yeah. So, in order to kind of accomplish this, he decides that the best way out is to strangle his own daughter to death.
That's dedication to your cause there.
It is, it is. But Bev comes out of nowhere and saves the day, knocking him out with the propeller. So she's still hauling this thing around. It's pretty impressive, I'm not going to lie. Alexis is, she's losing her mind at this point. She's just not herself. She's over here telling Bev, like, we can get out of this. I was used. I was manipulated. I'm like you, blah, blah, blah. She's horse-shitting her way out of this situation. Doing everything. She's desperate. She's desperate. That's what it is.
Yeah, she's a desperate woman.
She's trying to do everything she can to get out of this situation. She realizes now, after her father tries to strangle her to death, that maybe she was wrong. Like, maybe, just maybe, this wasn't the right thing to do.
Do you think she realizes that, or is she just trying to excuse her way out of it?
I think she's trying to do a little bit of both. I think it is her realizing that maybe she shouldn't have listened to her dad. Because I feel like your own father trying to strangle you would be a pretty big revelation in that regard.
That's a low point in someone's life, I think.
Yeah, and then on top of that, it's probably combined with the crushing weight of, oh, Jesus, I just killed somebody for this man. Mm-hmm. And everything else that she's got going on in her life at this one said point in time. And it's combined with her desperation to get out of it. I do think that it's a little bit of all of these things kind of piled up. So she's begging for any out at this point, but Bev, she won't see it. She doesn't want anything to do with it. She throws her out of a window in a dramatic and exaggerated fashion.
I mean, she sort of trips her way out of a window.
Yes.
She gets pushed away and trips over, I think her dad's arm.
Yeah.
Or maybe
she fell herself out of the window.
And then she just like fires herself through the window.
Pew!
In a very 80s shot. Mm-hmm. A very 80s shot. I feel like every single 80s movie where you see somebody fall out of a window, we see this exact shot.
The only thing that was missing was a Wilhelm scream.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
Turns out that Mark is still alive. And so as a result, the two drive away, him and Bev, I mean, manage to drive away, only to find Alexis standing in the road. Off camera, Bev proceeds to run Alexis over. It turns out at the end of the film that Butler has made it through all this, suffering maybe some mild head trauma. I don't know. He's being interviewed by news reporters that are asking him about the events that took place at his home, why his daughter is dead and all this other stuff, and trying to explain why the fuck there are dead boys in their house.
Dead man boys.
They conveniently overlooked the fact that his soon-to-be ex-wife is also dead.
That's true. They didn't mention that. They just mentioned the sacrificed man boys.
That's true. I feel like those would be the highlight at this point, though. Like, if you discover man boys just being sacrificed in a room that's painted in satanic symbols.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a coked out lady upstairs.
Yeah, you're not really going to worry too much about the coked out dead lady upstairs. So he manages to...
Sexism.
He manages to turn himself into a victim, claiming that his own daughter was led astray and joined a satanic cult. Bev and Mark leave together in the aftermath of this, going back to the gas station that they appeared at the start of the film and saying that maybe not everything is as it seems.
And I did like that shot.
And then we roll credits. That's it.
That's it.
The movie. Religion exploiting fear to gain followers. That's basically the message of this.
And money, right? Because that's how he paid for all of his fancy homes.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's what he does with all the donations.
Yeah.
Is buy his future houses.
It's a pretty powerful end statement. I think it falls a bit short due to some misdirection in writing choices during the second to last act of the film. Honestly, this could have been a much more powerful film if it was explored a bit more in depth, if maybe Knoxville's character had a little bit more bite, and the girl's motivations and religious ties, especially Alexis's, were explored a bit more in depth. All in all, I feel like we dipped our toes into the ocean that this story could have been and didn't really get the depth that it needed to make this really be something special.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I feel like there was a bigger story there that they could have explored a bit better, and I don't think that they did that.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting content, right? The whole idea of a mega church or it is, right? So kind of taking money from people to fund destruction and then taking that money back again to buy fancy houses, like, it sits close to the truth.
It does.
You know, it obviously not completely the truth, but you know, it has rings of truth to it, and I feel like that's an interesting topic to explore.
I do like that they treat it almost like going on mission.
Yes.
Where it's never the same three people that commit these murders. Mm-hmm. It's always a different group.
And they were the ones that fucked it up so bad.
Yeah, his own kid.
Yeah. But she was young, though. I mean, how old do you think they were? Like, what, 20, 22?
Yeah, I would say I think they're supposed to be, like, mid-20s.
But I think the assumption is that all of the girls that are a part of this church are younger.
Yes, but it's not all just... Is it all young women that are committing the murders?
Well, I was under the impression that
the whole
just...
congregation is women.
Yeah, the whole congregation is women, so they like they make a point of yeah.
That's why it's the Daughters of the Dawn. It's all like it's so that they briefly mention
the Quarantinis will do that to you.
Yeah, when Bev starts confronting Alexis about like I know what your dad does,
right?
She talks about like how he takes all this donation money that's supposed to be used to build like homes for wayward girls,
right?
And, like runaways and stuff. And instead of doing that, he just takes all the money himself and buys future houses.
Okay. Which further my points that it's such good material that they could have.
Yeah, there's so much there that they could have touched on and just.
And it fell really flat.
Yeah, never did.
Yeah. In the end, I think this just kind of ends up being another film about the fear mongering that was centered around the Great Satanic Panic. It's an early.
But without the 80s nostalgia.
Yeah, it's an. Yeah, you're really right. I mean, like, it's an early example of manipulation in media that is ever present today. We talk a lot about Satanic Panic on this cast, mainly because we cover so many movies that seem to revolve around the issue in the first place. But we've never really talked about exactly what sparked the fear.
Mm-hmm.
One of the largest sources of the Satanic Panic seems to be stemmed from a sexual abuse case that occurred in a preschool in Manhattan Beach, California. It's most aptly known as the McMartin Preschool Trial. During the course of the 7-year-long trial, the victims, and I use victims in quotes here because it's largely been dismissed at this point that any of these children were victimized. I made a number of extremely disturbing and bizarre claims that included graphic sexual abuse, torture, mutilation, and more. One of the most alarming accusations was that the abuse took place underneath the grounds of the school in an elaborate series of tunnels. When compared to the rest of the nonsense these kids spouted off, this actually sounds almost palpable because at one point during their testimony, they actually say that like witches on broomsticks attacked them. So a tunneling underneath the school actually sounds like it could be plausible. It's also been one of the largest sticking points of the case and has continued to be a prodding point for investigators to this day, with allegations of the existence of these tunnels continuing well into the late 90s. In fact, in May of 1990, archaeologist E. Gary Stickle investigated the allegations of the tunnels under the school and concluded that there was, in fact, evidence of a tunnel system that existed, and even worse, that these tunnels were covered up. Using ground-penetrating radar, he claimed that dirt was disturbed in tunnel-like formations dug deep into the ground, but has since been covered up with concrete slabs. People have challenged these statements since, claiming that the slabs were for newly installed sewer lines. But last I could find, Stickle continues to stand by his findings, stating that the tunnel system he discovered would have been much larger than necessary for any sort of sewer lines.
So they spent $15 million in 7 years trying to decide if or if not there are tunnels.
Right.
It's almost like basements under pizza places.
Yeah. Yeah. So take that as you will, but maybe, just maybe, there was more to these children's testimonies and overall fear that was felt by the American people regarding this panic. I just doubt it had anything to do really with satanic merits.
No, absolutely not. If anything, it was probably normal, upstanding citizens of the community that are sexually molesting fucking children and not people who listen to metal music.
Yeah.
Tipper Gore is going, especially
not 80s hair metal music. Yeah, like, dude, come on, everybody.
It certainly wasn't influenced by hair metal.
Absolutely
or heavy
disagree
metal.
With you.
What's that?
Who?
Tipper Gore will disagree with you.
Absolutely.
Is it someone else who wears a tinfoil hat?
No, Tipper Gore was Al Gore's wife that's responsible for the parental advisory content warning.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, Tipper.
Very much for similar reasons to this.
So if you couple those up with the allegations that took place during the Franklin cover-up and find comfort in one takeaway that remains a shining beacon of truth amidst a sea of bullshit, Alicia Owen did nothing wrong.
Here we go. Here we go, everybody.
I love how you conveniently left that very last sentence off of your script.
Yes, that was not on the Google Doc, everybody. But I saw it coming. Ding.
What are we rating this out of?
Ugh.
What is the thing she was carrying?
Outboard motor.
How many outboard? I was gonna say how many '80s Twinkie boxes in a sea of modern 2020 films or things. Perfect. Are there we rating this yeah. out of?
I'll go first. I am going to give this a 2.5. I wanted to like it a lot more than I did.
Okay.
For all of the reasons that we talked about.
Okay.
I think the content was there, but it lacked some follow through.
Okay. What about you, Sam?
I will give it a 2.25 mostly eaten Twinkie boxes for the same reasons as Alex, as well as I feel like I've seen this in the two other movies we mentioned at the start that just did it better.
Did it better.
Yeah. Wow. I'm surprised I'm the lowest one on this. 1.75 from me.
I'm not surprised you died in this movie.
Yeah, he has some, it's made him think about if he or is not a serial killer.
Yeah.
Why no one ever put bologna on his car.
It's just, it left me questioning far too many things.
Yeah, and why he died first.
Exactly. Exactly. That leaves us with a 2.16666666666.
Absolutely perfect to kick
off. Hell yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad. I'm glad that's what we ended up with here. Time for the housekeeping. All right, so I think the conclusion here is that we can praise Satan and hail crunchy riffs, but that wraps up.
Listen to more 80s Danish metal.
Yes, well, just metal in general. Honestly, 80s hair metal, 80s Danish metal.
Together. I feel like metal is far too categorized.
Have you guys seen this trend that's going on right now on social media? People recreating famous album covers.
Artwork? Oh no, I haven't seen that.
I've seen the
artwork.
The artwork happened already, right? But people have moved on to album covers now.
Amazing.
And so there was a meme that I saw on R Metal the other day that was like people recreating famous album covers and then Cannibal Corpse covers.
It's amazing.
It's that gif of the puppet just like looking back and forth.
Yep.
Oh man, next week we'll be taking a look at another entry that fits in even more perfectly than this one. Deathgasm. It's packed with laughs, gore, and an homage to all things metal. It's definitely a film that fits in to this month's theme. Conveniently, Sam and I have a metal album coming out, Ursa Minor, by our band called Holden. It's our debut EP, and it's out on May 8th. It's 5 tracks of hard-hitting riffage that run around 40 minutes or so, right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Thereabouts.
Reviews have been piping in, and most of them have actually been surprisingly good. I'm always struggling kind of to take compliments, so this has been a bit of a confusing time for me.
They're kind of still good.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
Yeah. But regardless, it's great to see such positive responses. Go pre-order it at judgeholden.bandcamp.com/releases. That's Judge Holden, spelled holden.bandcamp.com/releases. We'll put a link in the podcast description as well. In the meantime, you can follow us on social media like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all at Terror and Podnito. You can follow us individually too. I'm Palmer at Sturmsworth. The garden's almost completely ready, and there are a ton of plants a-blooming, so go check them out. Alex?
So I'm Alex at Instagram and Twitter now at A-Looters. Someone sent me a tweet and said, why don't you just fucking change it? So it's the same thing. I said, no, you're so right. Thank you. So now you can find me on Twitter and Instagram under A-Looters.
There you go. There you go.
And I'm at Sam Heaves, and I don't really do much other than lurk these days because, I don't know. But now I've got new deck furniture, and I did my first garden harvest, so maybe I'll actually start posting stuff.
I made a pie.
Hey.
Yep, and I drank Miller High Life,
kind of
a champagne of beers, out of a champagne glass.
There you go. That's classic.
It was a mixed berry pie.
Oh, okay. All right. I remember the days when I thought Miller High Life was a good beer.
Was the champagne. Someone gave it to me because the bottle was amazing. It actually was branded and looked like
like a champagne bottle?
Champagne
bottle.
Yeah.
New Year's ago, I went to a 7-Eleven for New Year's Day dinner and got a bottle of Brut. and Miller High Life in a champagne bottle.
There you go. Someone gave, I forget who it was, but one of my friends gave it to me. They're like, I feel like this is right up your alley. Trashy and classy all at the same time.
All at the same time.
I said, that's me, baby. That's me.
Well, everybody, thanks as always for tuning in. We'll be back next week, and like the quarantine, we'll hopefully be lifted. As always, Alex.
Keep it creepy.
Take care, everybody.